Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, I'm Sean Filer, CIO of Equinox Partners, and I'm pleased to be on Real Vision with Marcus Frampton, the CIO of the Alaska Permanent Fund. Marcus is an independent thinker in what is generally regarded as a very conventional sector. So, Marcus, welcome. Thank you for joining me today.
Thanks, Sean. Thanks for having me.
So let's get right to it. What is the Alaska Permanent Fund?
So the Alaska Permanent Fund was set up in the late 1970s after oil was found in Prudhoe Bay in Alaska, which at the time was the largest North American discovery of oil. So the fund, since inception in the late 70s, receives 25% of the royalty deposits earned by the state from production here. So, you know, we've grown from an initial deposit of $700,000 to today, we're at $75 billion. And so we invest that fund globally across asset classes. And then we transfer each year about 5% of the fund to the state, which is used for dividends and to residents of the state. So Alaska is actually the only longstanding universal basic income instance I'm aware of. So there's this dividend. There's no state income taxes if you live here. And then a portion of that transfer funds state government.
And do you have a specific mandate in terms of the return or capital preservation that you expect to hit on a long-term or annual basis?
Yes. So we target a real return of 5%. So that ends up at nominal around 7% if you believe the inflation forecast. It could, you know, higher if there's higher inflation. So real return of 5%, that ends up putting us right about where most state pension funds target, in that 7 to 8 area, and most endowments target it. So you have, you know, the whole, pretty much the whole institutional investment community targeting kind of the 7% return, and we're at that same level. For us, it's because we want to support the state with 5% a year and then maintain the inflation-adjusted value of the fund into the future.
So if I think about your peers, and I think as Americans, maybe we're not that familiar with state-based sovereign wealth funds, which you are. Are your peers really other sovereign wealth funds internationally, or are they more the state pension funds, or is that a distinction without a meaningful difference?
The way we're set up tends to look a lot like the state pension funds. Like if you look at our investment policy statement, if you look at the way we work with our board and our general consultant and others, we look and feel like a state pension fund. However, more and more, we've been trying to emulate some of the international sovereign wealth funds. And, you know, they run the gamut, but the largest is the Norway fund. Then there's obviously GIC and Temasek and others, which tend to have kind of a broader remit, more international investments, more direct private equity, you know, versus all through funds. So we've been moving a little bit in that direction, except if you compare us in terms of our policies and our setup, et cetera, we're probably most look like a state pension fund.
And then you mentioned your consultants. You use consultants, I presume, like most other pension funds and sovereign wealth funds. Can you give us some insight into how useful that is? What addition they provide, investment insights to what you guys do in-house?
Yes. Yeah, so we have consultants working on most of our areas. And in the alternatives area, they help with manager selection. There's another consultant that's our board consultant, Callan Associates. They do our annual asset allocation review with our board, which I think is probably the most critical decision that gets made year to year. And then the rest is execution throughout the year. But, you know, they're pretty impactful on that front. And in the investing environment we're in today, you know, those, that work on asset allocation is what's driving large flows in markets, because similar advice is given, you know, across the state pension fund world. And so I think one of the most interesting things that have come up recently is they came out with their 10-year forecast, which they do every year for the asset classes. And then they apply it to, you know, to what we invest in. It has real implications. If you're running a state pension fund, that's the basis for your underfunded status, is the actuarial discounting and then what you, you know, and so they have to build a portfolio that can earn a 7% return. In this last year, global equities on that study was under a 7% return, which implies a 100% equity portfolio would not achieve most institutional investors' objectives. You know, and private equity was the one asset class at 8.5%. And there's false precision in all these numbers, but real decisions get made off of them. And so that's why I think you're seeing just such rapid growth in private equity, is at this point, it's the only asset class that, in at least in Callan's case, and I think similar in other consultants, even gets you to, on a forecasted basis, to what people are targeting.
And then, unlike your peers, I think you are a little less conventional or a little more independent in terms of investing in asset classes and making allocations that your peers don't. Can you give us some background or insight into why that is, why you are a little bit of an outlier or differentiated from your peers in terms of some of your investment decisions?
Yeah, well, you know, I think our Achilles heel and all, you know, institutional allocators in the U.S. targeting a similar return, Achilles heel is periods of low growth and periods of high inflation. So, you know, if you look at a 60-40 portfolio, or you look at our portfolio through the 70s, it was a period of zero to negative real return with inflation where it was. And then in the 2000s, a decade with two recessions and a flat stock market, again, was a period of basically zero real return for a 60-40 portfolio. So, you know, the observation I've made that we implemented this year was that gold is the asset that does particularly well in periods of, you know, recession and low growth or inflation. So we've added a gold allocation. You know, hedge funds is another area that I think should be emphasized by allocators. And, you know, back to the consultant forecast that drives so much stuff, you know, they assume a 0.8 correlation and a 4% return for hedge funds, which probably maps to what the HFRI will do, or, you know, what they have done in the past. But I look at hedge funds and absolute return as you can, with some effort and skill, it's not unreasonable to think that you can find uncorrelated managers that hit a 0.7 Sharpe ratio with 10 to 12 vol. And then right there, you have an uncorrelated return that's getting up near what we're targeting for the total fund. And so it's such a valuable return stream that I think has been kind of like de-emphasized by institutional investors, at least state funds, probably less so endowments in the last decade, that, you know, if you use the broad HFRI numbers or these, you know, the capital market forecasts that were given, you wouldn't have any hedge funds. There's no value to the asset class if it's going to be 4% return, 0.8 correlation, but that's not what we're trying to do. So we just try to come up with our own independent views on these areas and apply that. And it's led us to do some things that I think are kind of, you know, common sense, like owning some gold and targeting uncorrelated managers, whereas others, I think, have just continually gravitated more equity and more private equity.
What kind of return expectation do the consultants give you on gold?
Inflation. So, it's when you score our portfolio, it only hurts us when we add gold. But the, you know, in their inflation forecast, like if you use my inflation forecast or yours, you might actually own some.
Okay. Yeah.
But their forecast, you know, Callan's latest, last year they had the 10-year outlook for inflation at 2.25. And then this year it came in, and this is a couple months ago that the new forecast came out. So this is post-COVID, you know, post 20% money printing. The new number is 2%. So, I don't know what went into that. There's certainly a deflation camp and an inflation camp. And, you know, to lower your inflation outlook in the last 12 months is a little stunning to me, but that's the forecast that's used for gold. And so it's dilutive to our expected real return.
What size investment did you make in gold, and how'd you do it?
So we own it in a couple different ways. Over the last few months, we've owned in the neighborhood of $400 to $500 million of gold miners stocks. So we've implemented that to the ETFs. You know, the primary VanEck ETFs. I think that it's an area that active management could is ripe to add value, but to get the positions on in the time we wanted, we did the ETFs. And then we also own IAU, the gold ETF. An issue we have, and everyone in our industry has, is we have the asset classes and the bucketing. So what we changed in our investment policy was that we could hold a portion of our cash in IAU, and we could put a portion of our hedge fund portfolio in IAU. And we didn't set up like a dedicated commodities allocation, which might make sense at some point. So we have somewhere around 5 to 10% of our hedge fund portfolio in the ETF IAU. So kind of an odd fit there, but it, from a portfolio role standpoint, that's where it made the most sense for us.
And how did you pick amongst the various gold ETFs? And, you know, in terms of doing the ETFs versus doing the physical, I guess implicitly you're comfortable that the gold's there and it's just a cheaper, more efficient way to execute it? Or if you could walk through that.
I think as an individual investor, it makes a lot of sense to own physical gold. As an institutional investor, the ETF made the most sense for us, and there's 5 or 6 of them out there. GLD is the most well-known. And I've actually owned that in the past and in my personal account. And then we did just a little bit of work, and IAU is like half the fee and similar liquidity. So it's kind of, I think GLD's maybe twice the management fee. So it's, you know, they were the first mover, but IAU makes a little bit more sense, I think, for institutional investors.
So let's go back to the point about stagflation you made, Marcus, and won't stocks protect portfolios against inflation, or it's a particular type of stagflation where gold does better than stocks? Or how do you think through that? Because a lot of your peers haven't gotten to the point where they're owning gold, and certainly not gold miners yet. Maybe they're dipping their toe in the water, but not really done what you guys have done yet.
I think it depends on the level of inflation, and the type of the data isn't great. You know, I went back and tried to look at how different assets correlate to inflation or deflation. And it's actually hard with gold to do the analysis, since for most of the last 200 years, we were on the gold standard. So, and then, you know, gold exploded in price in the 70s. I think that from the studies I've seen, I don't think stocks are a great inflation hedge. I think that they do better than fixed income does, but particularly when there's unexpected rapid inflation, a lot of companies, I think, struggle to pass that through. So, and that's why stocks didn't do that great on a real return basis in the 70s, whereas gold did. I think that there's inflation that's driven by an economy running really hot and output being near, potential, and that resulting in inflation flowing through. And then there's like monetary inflation from, printing money, and that can be, I think, a little less predictable. So I think the type of inflation we get probably will matter, but from what I've looked in the studies I've seen, gold is the best asset to own across both those types of inflation.
Did you have a look at silver as you got to your gold thesis? Obviously another monetary metal, high correlation to gold, but obviously different, much smaller market in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I mean, I think gold or silver is the natural second investment. And clearly in the miners portfolio that we have, we're getting some other precious metal exposure. I mean, gold is the classic one and the most time-tested one. And I think, probably makes the most sense, but an investor could add silver for sure.
Maybe just a question or two about the miners. How do you think about gold mining? Is it a way to invest in gold with more leverage? Are they undervalued in general, or how do you think about it from a top-down perspective?
It's a sector that I think makes sense for its own reasons, aside from just the macro environment we're in. I think there's some similarities to the E&P space where, you know, over the last 10 or 20 years, there wasn't always the capital discipline, and people are starting to see that now out of some of the producers. So it's definitely levered exposure to the commodity. I mean, if you just look at the NPV of a miner's holdings and, you know, if they have a certain marginal cost, you know, when gold's below that, it's a negative NPV, but then it kind of just exponentially increases as the price exceeds the marginal cost for a mine. So I know you know that well. So I think that it's a different exposure, and one that if you're taking it from a beta standpoint is easy to put on. If you're actively managing it, probably requires some expertise that we don't have in-house at the permanent fund.
And how do you, what about all the ESG issues involved in mining? I presume you have mining elsewhere in your portfolio as well. Is there any unique or different take or special processes or considerations you have to go through in investing in mining as a sector, given some of the issues that come up?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the reasons why we went with the broad market ETF, is we didn't necessarily want to get into judging, you know, which ESG factors we wanted exposure to versus the others. I think, you know, we're on a broad ESG basis. I mean, we're not avoiding certain sectors. So like, we like the oil and gas sector's outlook right now. Certainly want to be investing in companies that are good corporate citizens and following, you know, the law, but it, you know, we haven't moved away from resources, and that would include mining.
So you mentioned kind of in your inflation concern, the rate of money growth in the United States. And if you look at fiscal and monetary policy, I mean, I think your average observer is just, I think, shocked by where we are. Are we in extraordinary times, both from a fiscal and monetary perspective? And is there any going back to anything normal?
Well, that's a good question. I think that you can identify things that are happening in the last decade and then accelerating in the last year or two that are unprecedented. And I always ask economists and, you know, macro hedge fund managers that we invest with this very topic. I mean, it's hard to ignore. And there's a camp of economists and investors that focus on the Japan example and, you know, look at them for a very long time. They've been, monetizing their debt and printing money, and they haven't been able to get inflation. But I don't think that episode's complete. Like, and it's one country that we don't know how that story ends, because they're still in the middle of it. And I think some people similarly were surprised we didn't have inflation in the last decade here in the U.S. And again, I would say that this episode is not complete. So I think that they're now testing the limits of QE and money printing and maybe MMT. And I mean, I think that the end result, all the roads lead to inflation in the end, because these limits are going to keep getting tested every time we have a drawdown in the markets, every time the economy is soft. I think we'll continue to test it. And we saw a glimpse in late 2018 when, you know, Jerome Powell wanted to start tapering and the markets threw up on it. So I think we're in the middle of this episode here, and Japan is in the middle of theirs. And I think that, and we'll, you know, as we build up debt levels, in the end, there's got to be some austerity and some, you know, control over the money supply, or there's going to be inflation. So I'm in that camp, but and a lot of very smart, you know, macro investors and economists I talk to are as well. But there's not consensus around it, I would say, at this point.
When do we find out, right? So Bernanke got on 60 Minutes and told us that this is 2010. If the Fed had to raise rates, they could do it in 15 minutes and just we should all go worry about something else. And now for, I guess, 11 years or a little over 10 years, seems like there hasn't really been a problem. They haven't really had to do it. But at some point we find out, is there any sense in terms of the timing and where we're going to find out if he was right or if we should actually be concerned about this inflationary pressure and the monetary and fiscal policy?
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PI, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to podcasts on.
Yeah, podcast, homecast.
Your podcasting apparatus. Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Well, I think that if they hadn't moved the goalpost to an extent on when we would start raising rates, if they hadn't moved to the average inflation targeting, we'd be there right now and we'd find out if, you know, Ben Bernanke was correct. I don't think they know what's going to happen when they start raising interest rates. I think that it's an unknown because it's unprecedented. And we'd be at that point right now if it were not changing the average inflation targeting, because we're coming out of COVID, unemployment is trending to a reasonable place and inflation's trending up over 2%. And we've seen a big move in inflation break even in the last 3 months and in the 10-year treasury yield. So the market is kind of in a normal environment would be ready, I think, for rates to start coming up. And it's probably going to get delayed a year or two because of average inflation targeting, but we'll be there pretty darn soon. And I don't think that people really know how the market's going to react to that. So that's a concern. I think it's a reason to own gold.
And the fiscal policy, how does that fit into all of this, right? Because that's, I guess we just spent $1.9 trillion. Now we're going to spend another $2 trillion on top of the $6+ trillion we're already spending. And so, I mean, the numbers are kind of unimaginable in some sense. Is that part of it, or is that kind of secondary to monetary policy in the way you think about it?
I think it's the same concept, so to speak. I mean, we've had very low rates for a long time. So, you know, Powell and others have said it's time for, you know, fiscal policy to play a bigger role. And so it's, I think, a similar effect. I mean, you're talking about deficit spending, with the deficit financed with, you know, treasuries and those, you know, treasuries purchased by the Fed if the market won't bear it. So I think it'll be the same effect. I think a lot of people, when there were the Trump tax cuts, felt like it was, you know, stimulative to the economy at a point when the economy didn't need stimulus. And so, you know, fiscal action in the next 12 months has got to be in the same category of like, we got through COVID, what, you know, you don't need to be running high deficits. And so it's comparing it to monetary policy, I think, is it'll end up in a similar place. But perhaps, and I'm speculating because this is all kind of unprecedented, you know, the fiscal spending, if it's an infrastructure plan or if it's payments sent to people in their checking account, as things open up, may result in a higher velocity of money than, you know, quantitative easing or you know, some of the monetary stuff. So it may be a bit more of an accelerant on inflation than monetary policy, but we'll see in the next 12 months.
So we talked about gold, and which is obviously something that makes sense in the backdrop you're talking about here. Any other changes that you have implemented or considering more seriously given the unprecedented macro backdrop?
I'm trying to resist the pressure to reduce our fixed income portfolio. And so I think fixed income is an area that a lot of people have questioned in the last 5 to 10 years, but even more so in the last year as we've observed how hard it will be to hit the 7% return. It's viewed as sort of a weight on the portfolio return similar to gold. I think if you look at where like Shiller PEs are right now, I think that's the best indicator of the next 10-year return on equities. That metric would suggest a low single-digit return for global equities right now, not a 7% return. So to me, I think it makes sense to maintain, as an institutional investor, at least 20-25% of your portfolio in fixed income, just for liquidity, to be able to rebalance. And just frankly, I think fixed income's 10-year expected return is probably not that far from equities with a lower volatility. So that's one thing I'm trying to do is to just maintain some risk balance in the portfolio. I think hedge funds are really interesting here, macro hedge funds in particular. I think that's a way we can earn uncorrelated return. I would put like top tier macro hedge funds at a higher expected return than global equities, but most people in my industry would not, make that assessment. So those are a couple of things that I'm emphasizing aside from gold.
And on the fixed income side, you less duration because you're more worried about rates, less credit risk, more credit risk. How do you, any kind of changes within the fixed income strategy?
We haven't changed a lot. Our duration is kind of in the 6-7 year period, and we have a mix of assets. We actually own a fair amount of international sovereign bonds. So, I've had people ask, like, who are these people that own negative yielding German bonds? And it's us. And, we hedge the currency. And right now, the hedged return on European sovereign bonds are not that far from where the 10-year is. So if we got into a negative rate environment in the U.S. and the hedged returns of international sovereign bonds was negative, that would be a tough moment, I think, in terms of thinking about our fixed income portfolio. I mean, I think that that episode has occurred already in Europe, and by and large, European insurance companies and sovereign wealth funds, et cetera, haven't really made a big move that, they own negative yielding bonds. I don't think I would be quite as accepting of that. But we'd have to think of the alternative, and it might be something like commodities or hedge funds or something along those lines.
Switching gears here, Marcus, one of the things that you do that I think is different from a lot of other CIOs and specifically people in your seat in a CIO of a sovereign wealth fund is you do stock-specific work. You do micro-cap stock-specific work in your free time. Can you talk to us a little bit about that and kind of what you learn or how that informs how you behave as a CIO for the Alaska Permanent Fund?
So I do, in my personal account, I trade very small market cap stocks and over-the-counter stocks. And I kind of fell into it when I first came to the Permanent Fund. I was working on our infrastructure portfolio. And at the time, we had 3 infrastructure managers. So I would come in and kind of, check in with them. And then ultimately, I started working on other areas and got busier. But there was a period where I wasn't that busy. And I would do, like an under 5x EBITDA stock screen. And all the most interesting situations were, smaller companies. I actually had one called Callaway's Nursery, where I bought a pretty meaningful position. And then actually an activist hedge fund came into the name, and it turned into a successful investment for me personally. And so our trading policy of the Permanent Fund is Basically, if you're going to trade a stock, you have to see if it's in one of our accounts and then just disclose it. And with these smaller companies, I always look, but I never have to disclose it. You know, the smallest positions we'll have in our public equity portfolio are kind of 200-300 million market cap companies. So I've, you know, as a personal investing matter, you know, spent a fair amount of time, and I like to build, you know, meaningful positions in some smaller companies. I've joined a couple boards of companies I've invested in. So it's a great complement because it doesn't really overlap with the permanent fund, but it's also, I think, a source of interesting ideas in the market. There's such different worlds that I wouldn't say my microcap investing informs my permanent fund investments all that much. But you pick up little things on industries and trends and whatnot that can be applied. And I think for the most part, it's just that for my hobby, I like investing. And so I'm spending all my time thinking about businesses and investments instead of, you know, playing golf on the weekends, I guess.
So these are sub $100 million in most cases in terms of the market cap. Is that what are valuations like there? What are the issues that you get into when you're sitting on board? Yeah. You must really get into the issues in terms of whatever they are.
Well, so, you know, if you look at exchange listed stocks in the US, there's something in the neighborhood of 4,000 to 5,000 now. And I think before the SPAC boom, people were kind of bemoaning the number of public companies was decreasing. If you go not exchange listed, so over the counter equities in the US, it's more like 10,000 stocks. It's such a broad market. So if you look at listed banks, it's in the hundreds. If you look at over-the-counter traded regional and community banks, it's over 1,000. So that's a whole area. There's a whole area of kind of, you know, stocks that used to be exchange listed that have kind of fallen down, through their own issues and they didn't want to spend money on the listing. And then there's others that have just always been over-the-counter traded, just never had an exchange listing. And it's hard to kind of paint it with a broad brush. Like most of those 10,000 stocks you wouldn't want to own. A lot of them are, you know, shouldn't be publicly traded. And so it's a very narrow area that I look at. But, you know, I can find, you know, situations that are trading at, you know, fairly low multiples of EBITDA or book value. You know, if you sift through it, it's just a bigger universe of names that institutional investors aren't looking at. So there's more interesting situations if you turn over some rocks.
And are some of the businesses, are they, you know, fast growing and highly profitable and innovative and like kind of checking all those quality boxes in addition to being, you know, on an EBITDA basis or whatever multiple? I mean, are they, obviously got to be pretty cheap, but are they actually really good?
Most of the really interesting situations I find where it's like a high quality business are situations where there's large family ownership and through at times paying some employees some stock, at times different generations inheriting stock, you end up with several hundred shareholders. And so it starts trading over the counter. So one company is J.G. Boswell, and they're like the third or fourth largest owner of farmland in the U.S. and just very high quality assets, but a very private company and a very private family. But they hold an annual shareholders meeting and they're transparent with shareholders, but they just don't really want to be a public company. But that's a high quality company. It's not rapidly growing. So I think most of the interesting situations are more value stocks than high growth, but there are some high growth ones. There's one company that I used to own that I don't own anymore. Is a company called Mechanical Technology, and they spun off Plug Power maybe 15 years ago, which has become, I think, one of the highest market cap companies in the Russell 2000, a fuel cell company. And so Mechanical Technology has high caliber scientists and executives, but it's a small company. They got into crypto mining and the stock, you know, I owned it because it traded on a low multiple of their legacy business. And it was one of these examples where a company announces it's going to get into cryptocurrency mining and the stock like explodes. So you know, usually as a value investor, I'm not on the receiving end of like a GameStop type situation, but mechanical technology, which I'm now out of, is an example. And, you know, they might be successful, or they may not be successful in crypto mining. I don't know anything about crypto mining, but the market loves it and they're going to uplist to the NASDAQ. And, you know, I wouldn't recommend anyone buy it now because it's up like 15x, but that's an example where they did something that, you know, the investment community liked and there was explosive upside as a result.
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
510, is he declaring an emergency? There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
So are you still in, or you're out at this
point? I am out of mechanical technology.
It's got to help when you're then interviewing managers, right? And you're, as a stock picker yourself, you can sit there across the table from somebody that is a stock picker that's selling you on active management and their specific expertise. It's got to be easier for you to get to the BS factor, or to push harder in terms of whether they actually know their stuff because you do it yourself in your free time.
I would say it helps. I mean, also on, you know, my background originally was in investment banking at Lehman Brothers, and I worked in private equity for a while. That undoubtedly helps when we're picking private equity managers, that I've been around deals, and my team on private equity generally has a similar background. I think it's different than other state funds. So I think you're right that it does help, you know, as we're looking at active managers. And active managers are 70% of our public equity portfolio. So, you know, we've kind of resisted the trend that in the industry of, you know, really shifting to passive. And so I have it in my just core investment belief that, you know, if you own a stock portfolio, you should know the names in there, which sounds obvious, but, you know, at this point, half of assets in the equity markets don't follow that, that rule.
Help us a little better understand exactly how you make those decisions. When do you want active management? When do you feel like there's not enough value add from active management that you're better off just, you know, going with the lowest fee decision? And how do you make that determination amongst the sectors?
Yeah. So if you talk to most people in the industry, they would say large cap developed markets are an area for passive, and you know, in the small caps and emerging markets, that's the place for active. And that we haven't really drawn that distinction. So like if you look at the pie of our public equity portfolio, it's about 70% active, but that's across markets and capitalization. So, you know, will a large cap develop manager will run at a lower tracking error than a small cap or an emerging market manager. But we've tried to use our size to negotiate fees where we're not that far off from passive. And in fact, one of the things we've been working on is getting more of our managers over to very low base fee and then an incentive fee. So it's kind of like it's close to passive, but with an option on outperformance. And if you look at the 30% that's not active, it's not like the, you know, S&P 500 ETF. It's, you know, about half of that is a portfolio where we trade ETFs to kind of express our views. We're not doing single stock in that portfolio, but we'll have some sector overweights. That's where we own our gold miners and where we've expressed for the last few years a big overweight to value. And then the remaining 15% is some quasi-passive exposure that we have. So we have very little like actual index exposure.
So given where equities are in general, and I think you alluded to this earlier in terms of the expected returns, just buying a basket of equities now are low, which is one of the reasons to stick with a fixed income portfolio. How do you navigate that market? Where are you know, in long biased or long only equity portfolios, what are the sectors that are less bad or maybe even actually good in this time?
Yeah, well, it's a lot of people have observed the value versus growth discrepancy in the market, or the just vast outperformance of growth. And that occurred in the last decade, but the last year, 2020, was one of the most extreme years of growth stocks outperforming value stocks. Like, if you look at if you look at large cap Russell 1000, you know, the growth third of the market outperformed the value third of the market by over 30% in 2020. So, we have a tracking error budget on public equities, and almost that entire tracking error budget is devoted to value overweight, both through backing value managers and then through the ETF portfolio I mentioned. I think that value stocks could, when you come up with a 10-year outlook for the stock market, you're blending everything together. But, you know, bank stocks, energy stocks, miners, I think are priced to a good 10-year outlook, in contrast to, you know, the FANG stocks or Tesla or any number of these. The issue is we have a tracking error budget, and so that's kind of the extent of that bet, so to speak, that we can make. So as a whole, I'm still not that positive on equities, but, you know, value stocks, I think there's three or four sectors in there that you know, will have a nice decade here.
And in the correction last spring, you didn't get any benefit for being in value versus, you know, you should have just owned Amazon or whatever it is in the correction, which must have driven a lot of people, value guys that were concerned about the overvaluation of equities, just nuts, right?
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I think for the 3 or 4 years going into 2020, you know, value felt pretty beaten up and everyone was waiting for the cycle to turn and, you know, go into a recession or a drawdown, and that would be when value would outperform. So no one expected that big move in the spring and in 2020 of tech and growth just massively outperforming. But, you know, it probably shook out. I mean, it's been painful to be positioned the way we have. And we're finally, with, you know, this calendar year, putting up, you know, really strong numbers on public equities. But the first few years I was CIO, we underperformed our benchmark. And that can get pretty painful. And I'm certain that this last 2020 shook out some final, investors that couldn't take, you know, value overweight anymore. But fortunately, we've stuck with our positioning, and I think it's set up pretty well going forward.
What about private equity? So this, the temptation, right, because the consultants are willing to come in and give you a higher expected return on private equity. It's the one thing that solves everybody's problem, aside from the fact that valuations are very high now. Are we seeing a bubble in private equity? And then, you know, does that end at some point? Or what are the concerns to have there, and how do you manage it?
Yeah, well, private equity is a good asset class if you're a skilled allocator, because the range of top quartile to bottom quartile is probably 1,000 basis points in most vintage years. And it's kind of like the phenomenon where everyone thinks they're an above average driver. Every allocator believes that they're putting together a top quartile private equity portfolio. So the average industry performance, if it's 8.5%, like Callan suggests, is going to have a wide range of underlying performers. So we believe that we're putting together a top quartile portfolio, and the numbers have been very strong for the permanent fund in that area. But I'm just well aware that, you know, everyone kind of feels like they're doing a top quartile portfolio. I've spent my career in private equity, and I've never seen it as frothy as it is today in terms of valuations, both venture capital and mature leverage buyouts. So I think there's going to be a reckoning at some point, but it's hard to tell when that would happen, which is exacerbated by the nature of quarterly valuations and how accurate they are or aren't. So I don't know how it's going to play out, but I think that there's probably some investors in private equity that have put more in than they'll be able to stomach over the cycle.
What about, just finally here, on EMP. So this is a sector which is unloved. It certainly hit some shocking lows back in the spring of last year. Is a source, I think, still of a lot of the permanent funds inflows and funds from Alaska. Do you invest in it, or you have to keep it modest? And how do you pick companies within that sector?
Yeah, so we do still get royalty deposits. They're, you know, a lot smaller than they used to be. You know, production in the state here is on a slight decline. So there are a couple promising new finds on the North Slope. So they're now forecasting things to level off here and maybe grow slightly. But if you look at the last decade, there's been a decline in production in the state. It's a mature field. There was, under the Trump administration, some hope that there'd be an expansion into ANWR, so maybe the volumes in the state would increase. So I give that, but that's now not looking like it will be the case. So I think the base case for the state is, you know, kind of flattish production. And so if we're investing globally in energy companies, we're getting different exposure and different, you know, type of you know, E&P to the royalty exposure we have. So we do maintain that. And I think that, you know, as an investor, I have to look at the facts on consumption of petroleum, and it continues to grow, with the exception of, you know, recessions like 08 and during COVID. And so I think that it's at, you know, at sub 3-4% of equity indices. It's not a huge concentration. And it's, you know, one of the sectors that I think has a decent outlook when you factor in valuations where they are today.
And more gas than oil, North America versus elsewhere. Any other, you know, thoughts for those of us considering that sector or looking at that sector, how we might, where we might look or where we might find more?
Yeah, I don't have like inter-sector views. I mean, we owned for a while in that ETF portfolio that I described, we owned XOP. When it, you know, that mostly on a valuation basis from, you know, where it drew down earlier this year. You know, so I think, yeah, I don't have a forecast on oil versus gas, except to just say that the world continues to consume more of both. So it's not in that category of, you know, radio stations or newspaper publishers of a declining industry. And I mean, an investor can still make money in a declining industry, but that doesn't appear to be where oil and gas is today.
Marcus, I want to thank you for joining me on Real Vision. It's been, I think, just you've been remarkably direct, and you have a really amazing breadth of touch points across the investment landscape, given what you do at Permanent Fund. And I really appreciate you taking the time to have this discussion with me. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Sean. It's been fun chatting with you. I appreciate the opportunity to come on here.